are sitting in the meeting, like, okay, we got to hire a consultant to do this. It's going to cost, you know, it's going to be like a $20,000 minimum, yada, yada, yada. And like, I just remember sitting in this meeting as this like passive listener, and my heart was like, just like pounding. I was like, oh my gosh, like, what if I stood up and I was like, hey, Dave, that's the name of our CEO. Dave, let me try coding this myself. I've been learning. I can try it. I'll do it on nights. I'll do it on weekends. I'll do it for free. Give me 2 months. If I fail, then like hire a consultant. If I succeed, then great.
That is David Liu, a Salesforce technical architect over at Google. I'm Josh Burke, a developer evangelist for Salesforce. And here on the Salesforce Developer Podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. There, David is describing the meeting where he first started his journey of being a Salesforce developer, which ends up with his dream job over at Google. Today, we sit down with David to talk about his career, what he's learned along the way, and the people he's helped. To start, we talk about interviewing from the other side of the fence.
Well, actually, like on the other side of things now that, you know, I interview people, like,
yeah,
usually when I see people fail interviews, it's mostly because of the non-technical stuff.
Interesting.
I mean, I generally believe like anyone can learn, you know, any amount of technical things if they put their head down and do it.
Yeah.
But like most people just maybe aren't willing to do that. And so something I like to look for when I'm interviewing people is just like, How curious are they? How interested are they in learning stuff? Mm-hmm. Because they might not know the answer to my, you know, technical question.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they would put in the hours to learn it. Whereas someone else who might be very technical, like when they come across a challenge, they just might like fold, you know?
Hmm. So what are some of the things you've done in an interview to kind of pry out that non-technical angle?
That's a good one. The first one that comes to mind is actually one of the first interviews I ever did. It was at a company called NetApp, also in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And I remember the interviewing asking me, like, he asked me, what's my greatest weakness? I remember. Classic. Maybe this isn't exactly answering your question, but I feel like it's an interesting story anyways.
Yeah.
So he asked me, what's my greatest weakness? And like, if you ask like a job, an interview consultant, or you Google it, like, they'll often tell you to come up with some BS answer, kind of like, like, I'm a perfectionist.
Right. Or,
you know, something that's not really a weakness.
My greatest weakness is I try too hard.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, and so sadly, that's actually the answer I gave him. I remember.
Yeah.
And like, I remember like after I gave him that question, the dude just looked like, he just looked disappointed in me. Like, he's like in his mind, I was like imagining he's just calling me like a sellout or something.
Yeah.
And so like, that's when I was like, this is like the part of an interview where you know you really, really screwed up, but you don't really know what to do.
Right.
And I figured at this point, I would just come clean. And like, even though I was going to get rejected,
yeah,
that at least I could sleep well at night. And so I was like, David, and that's actually his name. I still remember this interview, David Thygeson. I'm like, David, I got to apologize. You know, actually, that answer wasn't really genuine. And, you know, I feel kind of bad saying it.
Yeah.
And then I gave him my real weaknesses.
Yeah.
Like I didn't go too deep into my insecurities, but like, it was like, you know, painful saying it. And like, the guy just immediately lit up. And I didn't expect that. You know, I was early in my career.
Yeah.
And you never know if like telling the truth and being honest to yourself is really the right way to go.
Yeah.
But it worked out and I got the job. And that was really big for my career too.
Yeah, no, I have to say I've been in David's shoes in the past, and it's authenticity and honesty was really important to me when I was sussing out a potential candidate, because it's kind of going back to what you're saying. If I felt like you were technically smart, but I'm not sure I can trust you, then I don't know if I want to put you on my team.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And like, you know, interviewers are just like you and me, like just, you know, like regular people. Like, we're not like, I don't know, some like corporate shills or something. We're just like regular people who want to, you know, work with people who we can, you know, trust and,
right,
and enjoy and, you know, learn from. And I don't know. So
my personal least favorite question to get during an interview was, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Because back then, it's probably about the same era that you're talking about, being at a tech job for longer than 2 years wasn't common.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I'm like, dude, I don't know what I'm going to do in 18 months. Like, how do you expect me to know what I'm going to be doing in 5 years?
Seriously. Yeah. I feel you.
So let's flip that script a little bit. As an interviewer, like, what are some ways that you frame questions and kind of get to that, how people are thinking about their job and about tech skills and things like that?
That's a good one. So I'll say I learned this interview method the hard way. Because when I first started interviewing people, I would kind of like do the traditional Salesforce type of interviews where you just like, you fire off basically like certification like questions, like, you know, what's the difference between a lookup and a master detail relationship? Mm-hmm. Right? Like how many days does something stay in the recycle bin? Just like really like useless stuff.
Right.
And like, I had made a series of questionable hires. Gotcha. like where I was just like, wow, I'm going to get fired if I keep doing this. Right. But on the flip side, once these people joined the team and once I started working with people,
yeah,
I found out that like, just like within like a short amount of time, just like one meeting, I could get a sense of how good they were and how good they would be long term.
Yeah.
And that's because during these meetings, they'd usually be like whiteboard meetings where we have these like open-ended generic questions that we don't know how to solve. Mm-hmm. And we just sit there and try to solve it together.
Yeah.
And so I just started interviewing like that. Just these open-ended interviews, like, for example, I might ask like, okay, let's start integrating Google Play with Salesforce.
Gotcha.
And then like, we want to track everyone who downloads an app and all the ratings they give to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like, you know, what data model would we make? You know, how would we integrate? All these sort of things, like just literally oftentimes problems that I had on the job recently that I didn't know how to solve. Like at very least, maybe someone could, you know, give me a better angle on it.
Right.
And then oftentimes these problems, you know, would be really, really difficult, if not impossible. And you just kind of like see like where people start to struggle and what they do when they struggle.
Yeah.
And that ended up revealing to me more about someone's maybe personality than the other type of questions.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point. And it actually, I think it's interesting you brought up whiteboard. My good friend and several times boss, Reed Carlberg, one of the things he kind of believed that if an interview didn't involve a whiteboard, it was simply not a very good interview.
Ooh, yeah. Dude's a smart guy.
So in these interviews, and I'll segue this a little bit, because one of the things I have found doing the podcast is that developers come from a lot of different walks of life. There's people like you who didn't come from a tech background, but got into a tech background. There's people who have like a computer science background, and they were kind of like always that kind of computer geek from the beginning. Are there any specific backgrounds that you do look for, or is it always just been kind of a diverse array?
First of all, maybe the most surprising thing I've encountered is like everyone I've worked with, like just across in the industry, like the best developers I've worked with, mm-hmm. half of them have no computer science degree. Half of them are people who just like woke up one day in their adult life and just be like, oh, you know what? I'm going to start coding. And so that has been like a data point that taught me that like, okay, don't look for the computer science degree, right? I don't have a computer science degree. And right. Like, I think I would hire myself sometimes in certain circumstances I would. Right. but so I don't really look for that. What I do look for is ownership over big problems. Because oftentimes, like, especially when you work at really, really big Salesforce implementations,
yeah,
where you're just like one out of, you know, possibly 100 people on it.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you don't really have to think and answer like tough questions to do your job, because a lot of it's like spoon fed to you. Like there's a design that someone else makes and you absolutely have to follow that design. There's like no time to question it, for example.
Right. Right.
Or like, then the company might move so slowly, you might never really like learn lessons from mistakes just because like the cycles are just too long. Mm-hmm. But when I see people who work in small companies who like own Salesforce orgs, like they go through the cycles of making a ton of mistakes, especially the long-term mistakes.
Yeah.
And just like figuring out how to fix them. And I'd rather they learn those mistakes at another company than at ours.
Nice. Okay. Let's step back a little bit and talk about something that you're rather known for, and I think delves back into that promise that you made, Mark Benioff. You're really known for SF99 or Salesforce for the 99%. First of all, what do you mean by for the 99%?
That's my beloved website. So I've always seen myself, and I still do, as this pretty mediocre guy who got thrown into extraordinary circumstances and got really lucky, but also worked really hard to get a job, a developer job at Google, by the way.
Right.
And like oftentimes when I think of people who work at Google, I'm like, all right, these people are just born geniuses. Right. Like, they're just really smart.
Yeah.
And they don't have to work as hard because they can come up with even better answers in a short amount of time. Gotcha. And I was never like that. Yeah. Right. I always have to prepare 10x of the next person. And I thought like, wow, if just like an average guy like me can end up working hard and get a job at Google, then I feel like anyone can if they follow a similar formula.
Got it.
Right. And any of the 99% of, mediocre people who aren't born geniuses. And so that ended up being the name. My wife really did not like the name, but she's like, you should be Salesforce Ninja. I was like, nah. And I'm glad I stuck to Salesforce 99.
Nice. When did you start SF99?
That was, I mentioned my first developer job was at a company at Box.
Right.
It was very shortly after it. And what I find really interesting about that is at that time, so Salesforce, SFDC 99, I teach people how to code.
Yeah.
Now, at that time, I had just gotten my first developer job, but I really lucked into it, right? I mentioned I got the job, maybe less on my technical skills, more on my non-technical answers. Mm-hmm. And so I was not a good coder. Like, I still think about that code I wrote back then sometimes I cringe. In fact, people who work at Box who joined after I left, they're like, oh, I saw some of your code that you wrote in, 2011 or 2012. And I'm like, let's not talk about that. We're taking that to the grave.
Right.
Where was I going with this? Oh yeah. So I made this site teaching people how to code, but honestly, like I was not qualified to teach people how to code. Right. I was still learning at the job. And so this is, 2012, 2013 or something around there.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter. Right. Like the site still ended up doing well. And I think what that taught me is like, there's no right time to really like pursue something.
Right.
You're never ready. Like if there's someone else who wants to make like a blog on being an architect, like don't wait until you get your CTA to make that blog.
Right.
Because then you're just never going to make it. It's like, Just start writing things down and the process of actually like building your website is going to teach you and force you to accelerate faster.
Well, so yeah, that was going to be kind of my next point because you're saying you're not qualified, but I feel like in some ways you're kind of uniquely qualified because this is an interesting communication loop that you've got going on. You were non-technical, you were an admin, now you're a developer, just quote unquote mediocre. But you're learning to be better, and then you're putting that learning out there for other people to kind of tag along.
Yes, yes. And that was something I didn't really plan it out to be this way.
Yeah.
But that happened to be like kind of the secret sauce of my website.
Yeah.
In that it wasn't a website to teach people how to code. It was a website to teach people who had never written a line of code in their life how to code. It was like an even smaller niche than like, general programming websites.
Right.
And that kind of taught me that like, surprisingly, if you want to like market yourself or a blog or something, that it's important to target like a really, really small niche, even though it kills your target market. It's like counterintuitive.
Yeah. Did you have any like lessons learned along the way for framing technical content for non-technical people?
A few of them.
Yeah.
For like, so I actually don't look at any analytics, which is,
really?
I think, something unique to me. Like I look at like how many visitors I get maybe once every like 3 years.
Gotcha. Oh,
wow. And so I didn't really get this feedback loop, but what I did get was I'd see the kind of the comments that people write on my posts. And so I found like if I wrote really, really long posts that, you know, people would not comment on it.
Yeah.
So I started breaking those down into small ones. And then I found that actually like the less technical the content, the more comments I got. So like maybe like one thing it taught me was like, so I was experimenting with different types of content. Like usually it's like, here's how to write a trigger.
Yeah.
And then one day I was like, here's like an inspirational story of how coding kind of like changed someone's life.
Yeah.
And like those ones just exploded. And so, I started like pivoting my website towards like also including those inspirational and completely non-technical stories. And maybe even to this day, like the majority of feedback I get is like, it's not thank you for your technical content.
Yeah.
It is thank you for helping me believe I can do it.
Nice. Well, let's change gears there actually quite a bit and talk to me about imposter syndrome and your encounters with it.
Imposter syndrome's a weird thing to talk about because first of all, I do realize that, you know, I got a job at Google, a very, very nice job, and somehow they haven't fired me in 7 years. So I must be doing something right.
Right.
At the same time, like deep down in my heart, like I sincerely believe I'm just this average guy. Like I've never really succeeded in anything in my life. I didn't get good grades. I didn't go to a good college. Mm-hmm. You know, I struggled to find a good job. I have all these insecurities that I feel like really bring me down. But maybe something I've learned is like, maybe in the world, there's only like 1% of geniuses and like 99% is just like average people like me. But like at a company like Google, for example, like, Google can't possibly have all 1% of geniuses. Like,
right.
Like you can't have a 100,000 person company and everyone there is just like a genius. Like,
right.
They're going to hire some scrubs. And so fortunately, I could be one of those scrubs that they hire. I think basically what I'm trying to say is like, you don't have to be a genius to be successful. Like you can just work hard consistently throughout your life and do better stuff than geniuses.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good advice. And I think that people who, imposter syndrome is, you know, pretty common in the tech industry in particular. And I do feel like it's always a good idea to be able to just kind of like, you know, check yourself. And it's like, you've been at Google for 7 years. So clearly you're doing something right. And whether you're a genius or not, right? So
Yeah. You know, maybe another thing that strikes me is like, you might be truly average.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to be honest, like you truly might not be smart.
Right.
but like, that's just your state now.
Yeah.
You know, like if you work hard for like a year or 2 years, then like you will become smart. Like,
yeah,
I don't believe that like you're just like your whole life, you're just destined to be one way. Like, I think I've mentioned this before. It's like saving money. Like if you just save like a dollar a day every day for your life.
Yeah.
Like you're going to be filthy rich, you know?
Right.
Just like the power of compounding and like just like exponential functions.
Yeah.
And so like at the same time in your life, if you just like work 1% harder than everyone else every day, then that's just going to compound and you're just going to be like, you're going to be super.
Well, I think some of this also falls back to, so, you know, my training back in college, I was an English major, thought I would write the great American novel, realized that probably wasn't going to happen, picked up a psychology degree because I thought that would pay the bills. But then it seemed like it was going to be a really depressing lifestyle. So instead, I got into building websites for companies. And so, you know, the imposter syndrome is definitely something I've run into in the past because it's like, you know, I'm the guy who just happened to be in the room sometimes. That's why I got that contract, or that's why, you know, I got that job. And but going back to my psych days, we as a culture think of genius as like, and intelligence is like a single thing. It's like a D&D attribute, right? Like you're an 18 and I'm a 16 and therefore you're smarter than I. And that theory doesn't hold up well. Like there's a lot of theories about intelligence that says that it's multidimensional. One of the favorite examples they give is like, would you consider a ballet dancer to not be a genius, even though they have this level of control from their brain to their body for what they do day in and day out?
Oh my gosh, Josh, you need to make a podcast just on this topic. Like I would like memorize that part. This is like so interesting. I know we can't go into it, but I love where you're going with that.
Well, I think there is an angle. I believe on your blog you mentioned Amy Oplinger. Am I saying her last name correctly?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's the second time I've actually seen a reference to her imposter syndrome presentation. So Amy, if you're listening to this, it's highly possible that I've got a prep call scheduled for you soon.
Kind of.
But okay, so let's kind of, and again, I want to move to something more positive a little bit, but this is another thing that has come up on the podcast and I think kind of related to this. And what is the role of failure in coming through a career that's lasted this long for you?
That I feel like maybe failure defines me more than my successes.
Yeah.
I'll list out a few of them. Like I have failed 20 certifications.
Yeah.
In the Salesforce world. Google has rejected me 10 times. Even though I call myself a technical architect at Google, I have failed the certified technical architect review board.
Yeah.
I failed 9 out of 9 categories. Like literally, like I could not have failed more on that. Right. There's only 9 categories to fail.
Right.
Wait, I got bad grades. Like growing up, I was like consistently a failure at school. Like it's just like, maybe the interesting thing about me is I fail so much that I'm somewhat numb to it. It doesn't even really bring me down anymore.
The idea of not trying again is not even an option.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And in fact, when I was learning to code, one thing that I remember thinking was, so I was like, can I really learn to code? Like, is this really it? I'm spending all these times on nights and weekends learning to do it. And like, it might attribute to nothing. But I specifically remember thinking like, what if one day I'm on my deathbed, I'm just looking back, you know, at career, I don't think I'll be looking back at career focused stuff at that time, but like
right.
For this scenario, let's say I am. Like, would I have regretted if I had just given up learning to code and just stuck in marketing?
Right.
Let's say I just learned to code and I just failed and I just kept learning, kept failing. And I amounted to like nothing in my life. Would I still be proud of myself?
Yeah.
And I remember thinking like, yes, like I have to go for it, even if I fail.
Yeah.
And that like, I still think about that in every context, like CTA, for example,
mm-hmm.
like, and it brings me some peace as I'm studying, like, even though I know I'm probably going to fail many, many times.
Yeah.
That like, that's just a step on the journey.
Yeah. And it brings to mind two things actually for me. When I was talking to Rachel Watson, who does, you know, like the Salesforce Saturdays and they're helping people train and all this kind of stuff. Like one of her quotes was like, we need to reframe failure, like as something that's not a negative. And it's something that is just part of the process. And it's not even an optional part of the process. Like you will fail and it will be part of the process and you will learn from it. And then we're going to move on.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like social media needs to change their algorithms to like index higher on failure. Like you just like you log into LinkedIn or Twitter, you just don't see that stuff.
Right. Well, and we lived in the crazy Instagram generation of social media where everybody is famous, everybody's rich, everybody's popular. You know, it's like, but not everybody actually is. So by the way, and then just and actually to kind of put a pin right in that one, I just and it will possibly have aired by the time we actually put this episode out in a conversation with Joe Castro, who does a lot of training for people who are becoming technical architects. Same exact thing, right? Like failure is something that you are going to use to learn. And he's like, we don't even really like to give somebody like a grade because we just want people to go through the exercise. Mm. And sometimes failing that test is going to be part of the exercise.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to something a little more fun. Mm-hmm. I believe at Box, if I did my research correctly, that you were involved in a few hackathons.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Were there any crazy projects that you're proud of?
So, man, that was a good time in my life, you know?
Yeah.
Like, year after year, I would consistently win the hackathon at Box.
Nice.
Which is just absolutely crazy because I was not this technical engineer.
Yeah.
I was just this like pseudo engineer, just faker trying to make it. And like, I would consistently win the hackathon.
Yeah.
And the reason why I won was like, the thing about hackathons is no one looks at your code. Right. You can write crappy code. In fact, you could even write no code.
Yeah.
Because your presentation is just the output. You could fake it.
Yeah.
And like, you would generally win on the quality of your ideas.
Yeah.
Which is a completely non-technical thing. And I've never said this in my life until now. Well, I actually won because of Salesforce.
Oh, really?
Because so Box, if you don't know Box, it's like a file storage company. It's mm-hmm. like Google Drive or Dropbox. It's just like that for the enterprise.
Yeah.
And when I was a Salesforce admin and developer, like there's like all this automation in Salesforce. At the time, workflow rules was really big. Mm-hmm. Where it's just like, if this happens in Salesforce, do that.
Yeah.
I just thought that was the coolest thing. And then when I'd be using Box, there was like no such thing as a workflow rule. Like, what if like, if I upload a file with a specific name, then automatically like tag it as sensitive, you know, just stuff like that.
Right.
And I was like, dude, why don't we just like bring workflow rules into Box? That was one of them.
Nice.
And so I just completely plagiarized Salesforce and won me the hackathon. In some ways, I feel like everything I do in my life is plagiarized, actually. But maybe that's another topic.
It is another good developer topic because like I have joked on the pod before that like Stack Exchange has been my IDE, yeah. Right? Like I don't come up with all my code myself. Like I'm constantly trying to see how somebody else solved this problem. And maybe I'll ask myself, can I solve it better? But I'm not going to necessarily start from scratch if I don't have to.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. That's like expose yourself to a lot of different things to plagiarize and then plagiarize it like 1% better and just keep doing that in your life. And
right.
That's like the magic formula.
But give credit when credit's due, of course.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah.
That's our show. Now, before we go, I did ask David about his favorite non-technical hobby, and it includes something we've talked about on the pod before.
I have a lot of hobbies. I play a lot of video games, but maybe first that comes to mind is snowboarding.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. If one day, you know, I make it and everything's done, then I would just snowboard every day.
That is
and so there's actually Salesforce events around snowboarding.
Gotcha.
Like Snowforce, for example.
Snowforce, right. Which yeah. I think Daniel Haas is on the record of saying, Hoax is on the record of saying that Snowforce is one part about, you know, talking about Salesforce and two parts being having an excuse to go snowboarding.
I thank him.
Thanks to David for the great stories and information on Salesforce careers. My thanks to you for listening. Now, if you want to learn more about this podcast, head on over to salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, see the show notes, and have links to your favorite podcast service. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you next week.